Thank you for joining us for another lesson from God's Word. The West Huntsville Church of Christ at Providence is located at 1519 Old Monrovia Road, Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Anytime you're in the Huntsville area, we hope you'll stop in and be part of our worship. Sunday morning worship is at 9 o'clock, with Bible class immediately following. Sunday evening worship is at 5. Midweek Bible study is held Wednesdays at 7.
It's good to see you all again. This is, for those that weren't here last week, a class that is basically we are reviewing, thank you, pictures that I took while I was in Israel a couple of years ago. It's not to show pictures per se, but the places that we went have a specific application to sections of the Bible. Last week we talked about a place called Caesarea. We're going to do the same thing again today, but it's a different Caesarea. And you're going to say, why are you pronouncing it Caesarea? I always heard Caesarea. I had until I got over to Israel, and the fellow from Israel was taking us on the tour along with our guided tour from here, and he kept saying Caesarea when we'd be in that location. So I asked him, I said, why are you saying it like that? And he goes, it was named after Caesar. So we call it Caesarea when I'm saying it in English and something else, of course, in their language. So that's why I'm using that. If I slip off and say Caesarea, just go along with me, whichever, and say it however you want. I don't think there's a right and wrong way unless you're talking to Caesar. You might listen to what he says. But that's the case. So today we're looking at Caesarea Philippi, and I hope we'll have a little time to get into Mount Hermon. But we're in Matthew chapter 16 today, and we're going to jump all around different places according to what I feel like I have time to fit in to our class discussion. So once again, as we look at the map, I just want you to get a vision of where we're at. There's on the right-hand, your right-hand side, then there's a yellow arrow pointing to a little green section there. And that's basically where Israel is. If you look to a modern map, it's identified a little bit differently, outlined a little different as far as the exact mileage or whatever. But that's what we're talking about, to the right side of the Mediterranean, to the east side. And so you see Italy up in the upper left-hand side, and this Israel on that side. Now, when we close in a little closer, then you can see where Jesus basically most of his lifetime spent, around the Sea of Galilee. South of that, a little further south of that is Samaria, and then further south, Judea. And we'll look at a larger map. But I wanted you to see on the left-hand side, the red arrow that's pointing, and that's a Caesarea, but that's Caesarea Maritima, right on the coast. And we looked at it last year. And a place called Joppa also, and has a whole lot to do with where Solomon brought in the cedars of Lebanon, and that was brought in into Joppa. And that was 900 years, roughly speaking, before Christ in that area on the left side, that red arrow. And so that arrow is pointing to Caesarea just a little bit south, of course, is Joppa. Caesarea now was where the Apostle Paul was when he was on trial. And so there's a lot to do with that. Acts chapter 8 and 9 deal, and chapter 9 particularly deals with a fellow named Cornelius. He was in Joppa at one point and then went to Caesarea to find some people. And so the two kind of fit together. They're very close together. And so as we're looking at this overall picture, I wanted you to see that was one Caesarea. And the other one is at the top of the page, and there's a bright yellow arrow pointing down. And this is Caesarea Philippi. And this is the one that we're going to look at today. Two different Caesareas. You know, if Caesar gives you a big land and you're a governor, you are glad to receive that special blessing or whatever, and you go ahead and name the city after him just to honor him. So this is not an unusual thing to have two cities in one area named the same. It's like we have today in different states with different cities named. So, and you can see on that city the Jordan River that flows down through that. It starts in that larger area on the top side there, that's blue, Sea of Galilee, and then the Red Sea toward the bottom there. Now, Caesarea Philippi, Matthew 16. I invite you to look at what's going on in your Bible and follow along with what the pictures are talking about here. It says, then the Pharisees came, Matthew 16, verse 13. And when Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? Caesarea Philippi. Now, you're seeing a large cave in the picture here, and as you get a little closer, obviously you get a bit bigger picture of the size of the cave there, and that's just one little section, but I want you to see overall that there's a large mountain region all around this whole area, and it's not just that one spot. Now, as you get closer, where the archaeologists have gone through this area and uncovered a lot of different ruins in that area, they began to discover an area that was well known as the Sanctuary of Pan. The Sanctuary of Pan, or Pan, depending on how you pronounce that word, has reference to a large area where there were a lot of different idol worshipers that gathered together. There's an artist depiction of this. I'll close in on this in just a moment. But what we're looking at is an area that is heavily involved with pagan festivals. And because of that and all these different activities there, lots of orgies, lots of drunkenness, lots of rituals, and a lot of sacrifices. This is the heaviest area in the, around that region where a lot of idolatry is being performed. And so as you close in, you can get an artist description of what's going on. And so they have buildings that are coming out from the side of the mountain in different areas. And all of these represent different gods that these people were worshiping. They were honoring. They devoted their life to those things. Back up one more here. Overclicked here. So way overclicked. Back up. There you go. One. Close in. There you go. So when we came into this area, we looked up and we saw all these different niches in the side of the mountain. Way back a few thousand years ago, there were idols placed in each one of these niches. I can't recall per se how things were set up, but I understand that there were different types of marble or whatever covering all of this. So it was quite elaborate. And each one of these little niches had their certain gods inside to worship as they worshiped along the way. And so there was the temple of the sacred goats on one section. When you back away a little bit from it, it looks like a bit of a walkway that leads you up. The niche is at the top where the arrow is pointing. And so they would come along and they would worship. They are offering their goats as a sacrifice. There was the goddess of vengeance. That fits well to anybody's day and time as far as the concept of us wanting to take vengeance on somebody or do harm, but it also had to do with justice and all. So it was a mix of the two things. But there was a goddess of vengeance in that realm. Next was the nemesis god. So if you have a nemesis, you can offer sacrifices that day to that god and maybe hopefully do something to that person. And so there was all kinds of gods to worship depending on what you were trying to achieve when you think about it. The shrine of Zeus, who is the biggest god around that area, supposedly, but until you get to another one, we're going to talk about it in a minute here. But the shrine of Zeus, and we have heard about that name for a long time. Well, they had that god involved in that. And this is one of the little places where they would actually, I guess, cut the goats open or whoever, whatever they were sacrificing, place it on a fire right there on this little rocked area and offer their sacrifices. But in this whole region, I'm going to back up here and give you an idea of what's going on here. In front of this, at any given time, there'd be some kinds of sacrifices going on. Types of orgies going on. Drunkenness taking place. There were particular times of the year where there'd be larger festivals, where larger people would be gathering in this area to celebrate what they wanted to do. Just as we have festivals in the United States for political reasons, they had their festivals, I think, somewhat tied to the political, but especially geographically and spiritually for what they looked at as being spiritual. back around here too. Coming into the area, there'd be large columns here. They have just half ones in most of the places. But just to visualize, this is an ornate area. We're looking at it as a bunch of rubble at this day and time. But this would be resemblant of walking into Washington, D.C., and you've got your statues and your pillars and all this other. And it was just a large display of power, of spirituality for their purpose or their way of looking at things. It fit to what they enjoyed doing and being involved in their orgies and their drunkenness and all these things. And this was part of their life. This was their worship. This is how they lived. So the question then, as you come to this and you're looking at all this, is this. Why did Jesus bring his disciples here? There's no particular reference in the Bible that says he did it during a time that there was some big festival taking place. Could have been. But it's pretty obvious that some things were happening at any of these, or maybe all of these monuments, these shrines, at the time the apostles and Jesus are coming up to this region. Very paganistic. Lots of orgies. And I think back to what Jesus did when he was beginning his ministry. And he would take his apostles here and there. When you look in the early chapters of John, right after the changing water into wine, Jesus goes up into the temple. Good. The apostles are used to walking in the temple. Do you recall what took place when he went into the temple? Anybody? Early chapters of John. He walked into the temple and he began to turn the money changers' tables over and running the oxen out and all of this. It seems to me that as Jesus begins his ministry with his disciples, he's taking them to places to teach them a lesson. The lesson to start with was in a familiar place. He turned the money changers' tables upside down, etc., to teach a lesson about this is God's house, not a place to make merchandise or to steal from people. Then if you'll recall, again, in the book of John, we've been studying that quite a bit lately, in chapter 4, when he's headed off in a certain region and he decides he's going to go into Samaria. Now Jesus is going to places where the apostles really aren't, how would you say it, relaxed, comfortable. They're going into a setting where they don't feel real good about. They've never been there before. No good Jew ever goes there. Now let that concept stick in your mind. No good Jew has ever been there. So they're entering into places with Jesus to learn a lesson into realms where they're feeling very uneasy. And possibly when they're in the Samaria, they're thinking to themselves, why are we here? What is going on? Now, when they come to Caesarea Philippi, and they're seeing possibly drunkenness and idolatry and some orgies and anything else, maybe a big festival going on, as they're coming around the curve, and they're looking at a mountainside that's bigger than this auditorium expanse with the niches and the different things that are going on. And they're thinking, what on earth are we doing here? Is Jesus, again, maybe thinking in their mind, I've gotten off track? Should he make a left instead of a right? Why would Jesus bring his apostles here? That's a question to begin thinking this morning. Anybody want to result to give an idea of why would Jesus bring them at that location? Yes. Okay. Because it's a reflection. They're going to be going into all the world. And this is a part of that world. A big sector, actually, once you get outside of Israel. Very good. Bill, do you have your hand? Yes.
This is the occasion when Peter made the confession, "You're the Christ, the Son of God." And here he brings them before all of these false gods to teach them about the true God.
Okay. So it has a connection to what's about to follow when Jesus asked the question. And Peter's response that Christ is the Son of God. Drastic difference. And that, there's a directive there that I think we can look at. And so we start with a question that Jesus asked right there in the verse. Who do men say that I am? I think if we just ask for a raise of hands, everybody could stand up and say, He's the Christ, the Son of the living God. Or you could say Redeemer, our Savior, our Messiah. All the things that are correct. The most powerful one, of course, yes, to claim exactly who He is in His connection to the Father. That He's the Son of the living God. But I find it interesting that Jesus starts with a question. When Jesus asks a question, as I've said before, it's never to get information He doesn't already know. Think about it a minute. When has God asked questions, but He already knew the answer? Anybody, any thoughts? All the way through the Bible, go back to the very beginning of time. Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden, what did He say? Adam, where are you? All of y'all have seen kids play hide and seek, and it's fun to watch the two-year-olds that have their feet sticking out from behind the couch, and you can hear them giggling from behind, and you're going around, Joanna, where are you? And you know, God knows where they're at, but He asked the question, where are you? Because He wants them to think on a spiritual side. Where are you, really? You think you can hide from God? Where are you spiritually? How about Genesis chapter 4? Cain, where is your brother, Abel? Cain, like God didn't know. But there was a message each time that God asked a question. And when Jesus asked a question, He's looking for them to think about what's going on. What is the right answer to this? And more than just the right answer, the title is, what will it mean for you and the rest of the world? And the answer comes from Peter, of course. Peter, you like this big storm we have on the sea? Let me out of the boat, Lord. I'm going to walk to you. You know, just he's always the one that's first out there. But this time, there's a little extra incentive. Because you remember when Peter responds in verse 16, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus answers and says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you. In other words, you didn't figure this out on your own, but my Father in heaven. I don't know. Peter makes some good errors once in a while, and he does some great things. He's first out there, and maybe God's saying, we don't want him to mess up this, and we're going to tell him what to say. Could be. Could be that God had already had this plan. Jesus is going to ask the question, and before Peter can speak out, which he probably will, we're going to tell him what the right answer is. But he gives them the right answer. But it's the answer that God wants them to fully understand. And then after he does so, and I say unto you, verse 18, you are Peter, upon this rock I will build my church. They're looking at this immense side of a mountain. This is the gathering point for the city. This is where all the animals come to be sacrificed, where all the people come to do all this. And it's an immense rock that just deplores spirituality for God and rings out of everything that is against what God would have us to do. And they're looking at this huge rock and thinking, how are we ever going to overcome this? as they're seeing all these shrines around. And Jesus says, I'm going to build my church on this rock, the rock that Jesus is the Son of God. Not that this mountain has anything to do with power or authority or anything else on this earth, or the guidance or the persuasion as it would have to those people in their lives. I'm doing something different that's going to make an impact. I'm going to build my church. And of course, that is the first time that the word church appears in the Bible, in the New Testament. The church that he's putting together, this assembly of people that belong to God, that are dedicated to God. This is going to be so much more powerful than everything you see around you. And then he adds this. And the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Nothing Satan can do, no kind of impact that he can have in the world, even measuring up the entire side of this mountain at the greatest festivals that they have, and maybe the hundreds or thousands of people. That artist's depiction that we saw back, a few slides back, I was looking at that and I laughed and I looked at it with Melanie as we were going back through things, and we'd seen this before, and I said, one thing the artist's depiction really didn't want to do is they have people that are just like walking along together, taking a stroll, two or three together here, two or three there, and a group over here, there. That's not what their orgies looked like. But they didn't want to draw that on their pictures. And we're thankful for that. But the influx that Satan had in that area was so awesome that Jesus informs them that the gates of Hades will not overcome what I'm going to do. So he brings them to this area. And he shows them probably one of the greatest demonstrations of what Satan does on the earth. And he talks about what God is going to do that's even greater. Seems like there was a passage. Yes, Eileen. It's the largest shrine that was there. It's the one that Eileen's talking about. That large opening, the cave opening. It's sealed off. Now it is, but it wasn't back then. It went all the way down into the earth. And at certain times of the year, water would rise up, certain seasons, and would come out and wash through the area. It gave life to that whole area, and they called it the gates of Hades. And this is what Eileen was talking about. She's been there. She's seen it. And so when Jesus says the gates of Hades will not overcome it, he was talking about that whole region, but particularly about that one section. You want to know how big that place is? There's Melanie and I standing in the middle of it. I was trying to figure out how I could block out ourselves through kind of whatever in front of this cave, but I wanted you to see the full size of the cave. And the niches that are all around her, they're huge. And it just demonstrates the awesome power that Satan had over this whole area. And specifically, the one that Eileen was talking about, the gates of Hades. That was the scariest place. They put niches up around the other areas. No one ventured down the cave. Too scary. Stood up at the edge because it was sealed off. But I did peek down there and look down. Just kind of, it was kind of eerie. What had gone on 2,000 years ago? Now, as you get through the passage here, he's still in this area, verse 21, and from that time, Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed and be raised on the third day. Pause right there. The apostles, maybe they left that moment to another spot to begin to discuss this. Maybe they were still standing right there, but there is no way you can erase from your mind what you just saw at this place. And with this full vision in their mindset, Jesus begins to talk about what is going to happen to him. And what does Peter do? Boy, Lord, that's a great idea. I think the whole world is going to gain from that. He takes Jesus aside. And how far away did he go? I don't know. Were the rest of them all standing nearby going, go tell him, Peter, we can't do this? Or was it Peter just deciding on his own that I'm going to straighten this mess out? But there was a lack of confidence in Peter about how this was going to take place. And so he's going to stop Jesus from doing this. This is too powerful. You can't do this. And we're not going to let you die because we need you because of these things. And Jesus' response, get behind me, Satan. Now, if he's standing up there, still at that location, I wonder if he looks at Peter and he turns around and looks at the cave. Or at least Peter's got in his mind the gates of Hades, the power of Satan in this whole region, the orgies and the drunkenness and everything. And he's thinking to himself, I'm just not sure that can be done. Now, we have been down to Samaria. We've been with you, Lord, and you made a great impact on those people. But they were pretty religious anyway, partially Jewish, partially not. But this is not possible. Peter's comments, as we're looking at this passage and thinking about where they were at, what they saw, the power that was exhibited among the people, his comments showed a lack of what in God's plan? Faith. They've walked away from this place. They're still envisioning what you've just seen in the pictures. And Jesus is going to be crucified? I'm following the plan so far, Jesus. I've said, I'm here. I'll walk with you. I'll be one of those fishers of men that you asked me to be. But what you're talking about, this can't be God's plan. God doesn't do those. He's not going to kill you. We're going to stop this. This is going too far. We can't envision, get that word, how that's going to ever be a blessing for us. And the lack of faith also in Jesus and God being great enough, powerful enough, strong enough to really overcome what we just saw. And so, as I'm thinking about that, and they walked away thinking about this, and again, we have no way of knowing because we weren't there, and the Bible doesn't indicate exactly how close were the apostles. Were they in on this, and Peter was the spokesman? Did they see Jesus and Peter arguing over there and not really know what's going on? I don't know. But there's always discussion going on among the apostles. That for sure we understand. Most of the time when we hear about it, it's more of an argument of who's the greatest. But they were constantly talking. You get a bunch of, get 10 engineers together, what are they going to talk? Engineering. That's what they do. Get a bunch of sportsmen together, what are they going to talk about? What team's the greatest? They're always talking about things. Put ladies together, you know, any number of things. And I don't want to just say sewing and cooking, but those are great things that they do, but a lot of other things. You just put a group of people together and they begin discussing something they have in common. What they had in common as apostles, they were apostles. And they've been following Jesus. And so they're walking away and they're thinking about, how does this fit me? How is this going to influence me and what I'm doing in the rest of my life? I've said, okay, I will follow you. I left everything. Now I'm with you. And this is too much. Is this a moment to turn back? Can this really work out? So the question, I guess, as we think about it, because we engage a lot of times in the same thing, in what's going on. And I spend sometimes a few moments every day, sometimes a little discussion, my wife and I, or with friends that I'm talking with. What is God's plan? How do I fit in? And I can't find it on the pages here, but I know what I'm supposed to do is written about here. And do I trust God in letting it just happen? And what's going to happen? Do I have faith that God is going to really fulfill that? Is the gates of Hades too strong for me? Comments? At all? Thoughts worth thinking about? Let's go to one more thing here. Is God still working? Yes? Yes. Okay. That's something to leave with. Just like the apostles had when they walked away. And they saw all of that. They saw Satan's power really demonstrated. We get out in the world and we see it. We see it at work. We see it in the government. Not the government bad in a sense, but just all the interaction, what's going on, the wars and the stock market and the jobs and the protests. And is God really still working? Is he kind of abandoned the United States? Was he ever here? Maybe at the beginning, but I don't know now. What's happening? But the bigger question is God still working? My answer is yes, always. Even when I see the power so great that I'm not sure how it's going to turn out. Okay, so chapter 17. After 6 days, 6 days from what? After the visit to Philippi, to Caesarea Philippi, after the big expose in front of this mountain, do you think they've forgotten that? You could think back to some things that happened in your life. An accident or some major tragedy, whatever. 911. Have you forgotten yet? No. Everybody that's seen that remembers it. Remembers the tower smoking, the plane that came in and dropped the set. We just remember that. 6 days later, these guys still have got this image in their mind. And the Bible really doesn't tell us if the 12 went with them up to Mount Hermon or just the 3. But it says, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, and led him up to a high mountain by themselves. It doesn't say what mountain it is here. But when you're in this region or you're looking at it geographically from an airplane or whatever, there's only one high mountain in that area. It's Mount Hermon. And it's a short distance. Looking on the map, seemed like it was maybe about 20 miles. You can make it in a few days. But every step you're making, you're still thinking about this and what Jesus said, what Peter said, what Jesus said back. And it's like, and so they get up to the mountain and the 3 go up there. Peter and James and John. Verse 2, and it says, and he was transfigured before them. What does that mean? Well, it describes it. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with them. And the reason they know it's Moses and Elijah is, I guess, because Jesus is having a little conversation. Maybe Moses says, well, Elijah, let's ask Jesus how it's going down there on earth. We know what it's like. We've been there. Or some way or another, all 3 and the apostles knew who it was. Then Peter, verse 4, answered and said to them, Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. Much better than the one we saw down over here with all their niches. We're going to erect our own little place over here. I think that may be what they're thinking, at least to some degree. And if you go to Israel, you'll find places they consider to be sacred spots where they put a shrine over. But after 100 years or whatever, the shrine wasn't big enough, so they put a small church building over it. And then they put a larger building over it, and then it become a cathedral over that. And someday we'll get down to Jerusalem, we'll look at some of those places where they actually did some of those places, possibly where Jesus was crucified, and along that area. Church of the Holy Sepulchre is one of the places. If you want to do a little Google search on that, we'll get there someday. But that's the way men think. Let's build a shrine because we're going to honor this and we're going to make a name for this area, and had nothing to do with that. But the thing is, as Jesus is being transfigured and they're looking to build this, they're wanting to compete. Like, my shrine's bigger than your shrine, or we'll build one too. And that wasn't the way God was going to work. So let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. Yes, sir.
I was thinking of my short visit there. And if somebody thought something happened here, they built something on it.
Right.
I mean, the land is full of places. We think this happened, we think that happened, we think that.
We don't know where it was in many of those places. Very true. Not like the United States, where if something happens, we don't build a shrine there too or put a statue there too. It's just typical. People do that. And so they thought they were doing something cool, something good. But as we're getting there and discussions going on, while they were still speaking, verse 5, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and suddenly a voice from the cloud spoke, saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Hear him." Well, if this is a cloud saying, "This is my Son," you know who's speaking in the cloud. Because Peter's just said the Father and the Son are connected together. He's the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now the Father's speaking. They fall on their faces. They're scared to death. I would be too. I'm surprised they weren't just at Jesus glowing. But they'd been so close to Jesus, they still felt comfortable, even though he changed somewhat in his aspect. And being with Moses and Elijah, oh, that's cool. And all this discussion's happening here. And again, I asked myself, what's going on? And as we read the rest of it, they fall down, they're trembling. They fell on their faces, and they're greatly afraid. Jesus comes along, taps him on the shoulder. I'm going to paraphrase. "Get up, guys. Don't be worried." And they looked up, and it was just Jesus, like it's been before. But things had changed. I believe what's going on here is he's trying to erase what they just saw on that hillside and the fear and the power they felt like that held. And that would be greater than God's plan. And so now they're going to capture an image of a real God. At least the cloud and the lightning. And how Jesus fits into this plan. He will come eventually, not far down the road, as you read in the book of Matthew, and we know, with a different kind of plan that fits anything else on the world. But it's a plan that causes us to fall to our knees and to just grasp how great God is. And the fact that no matter how much goes on in the world around us that just looks Satan cursed in every way, and we certainly see that in the United States and around the world. Visited, I guess, a couple years ago now, and been a couple times to India to visit one of missionaries that Central supports down there in a place called Pedaputi. Paganism was a whole new picture. I walked out of a little hotel that we stayed in, this little town. That's first bell. And I'd go from about here to the doors, to the end of the corner, and there'd be a little shrine. Buried some flowers around it and some money thrown down there. Nobody touched the money because the guy that owned the shrine, he would take care of that. And I'd go another block and there'd be another shrine. And I'd go another block and there'd be a huge one. And then one in between. I could almost throw a baseball at my age, the distance from one shrine to the next. There are that many shrines. And I'm looking around thinking, I was just in awe at how much power Satan had over the hearts and the minds of these people. And if we hit that sometimes, and we do occasionally in our lives, just remember, as the apostles were looking at all of this, there's still a plan. God will overcome it. This is my son in whom I'm well pleased. He knows what he's doing. He's got the plan in mind, and he's going to follow it. And the question is, do we trust it? And can we live with it? Struggle through it. It's not going to be an easy pathway, but we can manage it, even when we fall and do dumb things like Peter and other of the apostles. I guess they pick on Peter because he was the guy that just spoke up so much. Let's pick on Peter. Even John picked on Peter by the fact that when Jesus was resurrected, it said Peter and John ran to the temple, but the other disciple, that is John, outran him. And so it's kind of funny. They still say things about one another. We have our quirks. We have God. Yes. That's right. The other time that it was mentioned from the Son of God was at Jesus' baptism. This is my son. From the beginning of his ministry to the very, well, the middle part here, and then on the cross, a full demonstration, God's plan is at work. So that's where we're at for today. Lord willing, we'll pick up next week. You have a great week. As you leave here, keep trusting.
We hope you have enjoyed this lesson from God's Word. If you would like to continue your study of New Testament Christianity, please send your name and address to World Bible School, West Huntsville Church of Christ, 1519 Old Monrovia Road, Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Or if you prefer, send your name and address by email to wbs@westhuntsville.org.